Welcome to Rails with Jason. A quick announcement before we get on to the show. The new Rails testing course that I've been working on is available for sale starting this week. The course is called Intro to RSpec Syntax. There's a link to the course in the show notes as well as a discount code to get 30% off. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Tyler Williams, software engineer at Home Game Poker. Tyler, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jason. It's good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure thing. So as Jason said, I am the software engineer at Home Game Poker, which is a startup that is working to make home games of poker easier to play online. The product is launching sometime in the next month or two, so we're not quite out yet. I have a day job, which I will not be talking about, but at my day job, I also do software development, mostly Rails and Vue.js. And at Home Game Poker, it's also Rails. We have a React front end for the game client itself. Software is very much my hobby and my passion. I'm getting a master's degree in software engineering. And I've been working with Rails since like the summer of 2016. So, I guess 4 years now.
Yeah, that's great. I've been working with Rails since like 2011. So coming up on 10 years, it's great. And I don't think I ever want to do anything else. So we're going to do one of those episodes of, How I Built It, my new theme. This is the second episode of How I Built It. How I'd Build It. Still getting used to the title and all that. Anyway, I think what we'll do is I'll let you give a description of your scenario. And you had already submitted to me like a description of what you have going on and the programming challenge that you're facing. And I have some notes here as to how I think I might approach it. But first, let's hear it from you. What is the thing that you're working on?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, so this is for Home Game Poker. And we are it's a company that's building basically like a poker game client. One of the differentiators here is, I'm not a lawyer, so these are like my best understandings of gambling laws in the United States, right? But basically, like, if you're going to do real gambling, you have to be a casino, and casinos are highly regulated. But it is legal for people, like private citizens, to play card games, poker, and do what's called a home game. And in a home game, you buy in. You say, hey, here's $50. That represents these chips. We play the game. And then at the end of the game, everyone pays their friends, like in their home, they pay what percentage of chips they have, right? They kind of divvy it up at the end. This is what happens in real life physically. And the way that that's legal is you don't take what's called a rake, which is when a real casino, playing with casino poker, takes some percentage of the chips off the board or off the table, like at the end of each hand or at some other predetermined time. So if you don't do a rake, you can play poker with your friends. If you do a rake, you cannot play poker with your friends. Online poker is also in this weird gray area. Most of the United States legal poker sites do not allow you to play for money. Instead, you play for basically like pretend chips. And they're just like imaginary points, right? The profit model for those poker sites is people buy chips so that they can play with their friends. Because the chips are not real money, those poker sites take a rake from the table, which is fine if you're just playing online poker to like practice playing poker. And a lot of times they'll do tournaments and stuff, and they'll do all the regulatory things you need to like win money and like really play the game. But if Jason, you and I wanted to have a game and we played with like a US like legally checkmarked okay game client to do it, they take a rake of the imaginary chips, because it's not illegal for them to take a rake of something that isn't money. And that's how they encourage us to go spend more money on their platform, right? Because if they take a rake, they're constantly taking chips out of the ecosystem. So the differentiator for home game poker is we don't take a rake, right? You buy in the game, you get imaginary chips. It's not money. You play with your friends, and then you and your friends can do whatever you want to do about the information about the outcome of that game. And we're not going to go mess with your statistics. So as a setup for kind of like what this platform is, we have this real-time interactive poker game built on Rails. Right now I'm using Action Cable. My understanding is there's a handful of replacements for Action Cable that may scale a bit better, but I'm kind of sticking with the framework until I run into problems. And here is kind of like the last big feature set that we care about. So in poker, and especially online poker, but you know, any in-game or in-person game as well, there's time limits for actions, and those time limits matter. So you can say basically every person has, it's a very typical one, is like 15 seconds to take an action, right? And so we've got this poker game, you've got a Rails server that knows the game, the state of the game. And the way that the game client is basically like a React front end that's like a dumb terminal. And so it's hooked up to WebSockets. I have two WebSockets, one for like globally available information, right? The community cards, things that every player needs to see. And then one for player specific information. So like your hand, right? So you never want to broadcast that information on the same thing. Like you don't want someone to crack open Inspector and like see what everyone else has, right? Mm-hmm. You certainly could do that. And you know, we are playing the target audience here is friends. So it's like, we're not terribly concerned about bad actors, but we do want to provide like a secure, like that's just something that you would expect, right? Is that my friends can't go see what hand I have. That's like a reasonable expectation. So kind of the same thing with this timer. And here's where the challenge gets. It's like, because you're playing a game that could like may or may not involve money, you know, we have to be really careful about making sure that the rules are enforced appropriately and that they're enforced consistently. So here's what happens. If a person takes an action, and here are kind of like the things that might happen in the game. So if someone bets, they call a bet, they check a bet, they fold, go all in, they raise, or if the community cards get dealt, so either the initial hands or the flop, the turn, the river, these are all basically like sequences in a poker game, at the end of which the next player whose turn it is to take action, their timer needs to start. But, and here comes the challenge, all of those actions I just listed, they have associated animations on the front end. And so it's not as simple as saying, as soon as this person's turn begins, start the timer, because we don't want them to be on the clock until all of their animations have resolved and finished. I think that's a reasonable expectation of anyone playing a game. If you've got this visual information of the animations, you're like, okay, I'll wait until the cards get out before I make a decision. Because that's, the animations also like communicate visual information, right? Like, I don't want to start the timer for a person to make a decision about the flop until the flop cards are out there on the table.
Yeah, so to put it another way, your turn doesn't really start until after the animations are over.
Precisely, yeah, when it comes to like the full game, right? Because the logic of it is very straightforward. Your turn does start when we've dealt the flop and when that information is updated. And on the back end, it happens very immediately. So the technical limitation becomes, you know, I've got on my animations, I have timing functions, right? But they're not as reliable as I would like. Like, I would like to be precise. So if for some reason someone's got a slower browser, or like if an animation fails, because you're moving stuff on the DOM. And so if stuff fails out, we've got a serious problem. And so what I'd like to do is the timer needs to start at the end of the animation. We need to give the player enough time to like see the animation and get ready to go. They need to be able to have an accurate timer. The rest of the table needs to see that their time has begun. And then here's the final thing. Again, because we're dealing with what might be a sense, you know, you've got potentially money involved, so that matters. I think there's a risk. I think there is a risk of some, maybe not bad actors, but people pranking their friends, or like maybe you just got a jerk at your table. We want to make sure that there's no way for a person to basically give themselves an infinite timer. Because now, if we're waiting for their client to give us some information, no longer is that client just like totally isolated. We need to get something back from the browser, and it's feasible that some technically proficient person could stop us from getting, could stop the server from getting the information it needs to enforce the correct rules. So we want to do, so we want to have some safeguard in place, not only for a user experience, we have a user experience requirement that is animations complete before turns begin, but we also have a like reliability requirement that at no point can a person interfere with their timer, and we have to have some safeguard that like keeps the game basically following the rules. So I think those are really the requirements. Start turn timer, got to worry about animations. We also have to guard against people messing with the messages that are being sent and the timing of those messages.
Okay.
And then finally, for the context, you've got a Rails server, you've got a React front end, and you have two WebSockets running on a Rails server.
Okay. And before I share my thoughts on it, do you have an idea as to how you might code this?
I do. I would actually love to hear yours first. So I've... since I submitted this question, I figured it out and I did the thing. I'm feeling pretty happy with the solution, but I actually want to hear your thoughts as a person, like as a third party, like without any context.
Yeah, totally unbiased.
So if you don't mind, can we flip that?
Sure. Okay, so here's my thought. So the way I phrased it in my notes is when the page loads, but it's not exactly when the page loads. It's when the animations finish. So when the animation's finished, here's one way you could do it, but is not a good way. One way is that you could just save in JavaScript the time that the turn started and keep track of that just purely in JavaScript. But the problem with that is you could conceivably refresh the page and reset your turn. So that's no good. So my thought is that when the animation's finish, the front end could send a request to the back end and say, hey, the start of the turn was 2:18 p.m. and 6 seconds. So keep track of that back end. And the back end will persist that timestamp in the database. And then if you refresh the page, it will check. And it'll say, hang on a second. Is there a turn already started for this user? If so, don't start a new one. Just go based on the timestamp that we saved originally. And if there's not, then of course, create a new turn with a timestamp. So that's how I'd approach that part. Let me consult my notes and see if there was anything more to it. I think that's all there was to that part. The only other note that I had was like how I would structure the actual database table. I would have like a turns table with a user ID column and a start time column. And I think that's all that would be necessary for the database table as far as I can think. So that's what I came up with.
Sure. Let me ask you a follow-up question about the implementation. So I think you're pretty spot on with what I've got going. But again, let's think about worst case scenario. And let's think perhaps we cannot trust our friends or the people who've been invited to this game. So you said that the front end would send and store some timestamp of when those animations ended, effectively marking the beginning of the turn, right? What if you've got a user very technically proficient, maybe that user is literally me, and they've like kind of cracked open the JavaScript and they see that that happens, and they write a little script that they inject into like their browser console. And they say, you know, hey, before you send that timestamp info, don't. Or like they give themselves a future timestamp. What do you do? Like, how would you protect against someone who's acting like in an extremely malevolent way?
That's pretty interesting. Because, yeah, with the solution that I described, the user could conceivably alter the JavaScript on the page so that it behaves differently. I don't have an answer off the top of my head. Did you figure out a way to come up with that to meet that need?
Yeah, I did. And that was, it involves some compromise about how strictly and precisely you want to enforce timing decisions. But that is really, I think, the crux of this problem. So I think it boils down to two technical challenges, one of which you've solved. And I think it was kind of the more straightforward of it, although it took some time for me to arrive to and mull it around in my head. So the first one is, you know, how do we start the turn appropriately? Can we start when the animation's finished? Because we can't always rely on that timing information. So, and that's really sending that timestamp to the server.
Sorry, one second. I'm going to interrupt you and chime in with something. So I thought of a way.
Okay, cool.
And I want to say it before you say it, because I want to see if ours are the same.
You want to take credit for it.
I want to take credit for it. I also want to see if ours are the same. So presumably on your turn, you're taking your turn because you have to take some action. You're going to bet or you're going to call or whatever.
Yes.
So a way to at least prevent the case of not sending that request at all that starts your turn, you could add something that says, don't let the user bet or call or take any action unless their turn has actually been started.
Yeah, I think that's not how I solved it. And so to push back on that a little, it's not just what if I block my timestamp? What if I alter my timestamp?
Right.
And if you've been, and if you're technically proficient enough to go and alter these timestamps or stop them, I think that you're also probably proficient enough to like figure out how to trigger more messages to the server. And so what if you're not blocking your timestamp, but you're constantly updating it? You drop a script in the console that says, hey, every millisecond or you know, like get a request frame update, right? And so like every time the screen refreshes in the DOM, like, go update my timestamp so that you've so you no longer have to worry about your timer. You effectively give yourself an infinite timer.
Well, that problem's easy. Just don't allow turns to be updated.
Interesting. Also not how I solved it. I like that. So it gets updated once and then you lock it out entirely?
Yeah, you can create it, but you can never update something after it's been created.
Sure. How would you do that in, I can't think off the top of my head of like what you would do in like an active record model to stop the update function?
Oh, I would just only have a create action on that controller.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I guess I should say too is I'm not using controllers here. So with the WebSockets, you write out channels and you can actually just define like Ruby methods. So you don't have to be like RESTful in that way. So when the client takes any action and say setting that timestamp, it would actually say in JavaScript in the like consumer code, you would give it something that says, you know, this dot, I forget the syntax, but it's like this dot run something or like this dot execute. And then you give it a string which matches a method name in your Ruby code. There's like a like channel.rb file that you set up and basically you give it the string of the method and then it executes that. So like to some degree, if you've got, but I guess you could adapt that approach and say, you know, this timestamp update function or the method only runs once or like some other guard in the method that you would say like only create the turn, don't expose any sort of update stuff there too, because you are still limited in basically, you know, you can tell your JavaScript to try and execute any string. You can say et cetera, like you just make it up and kind of send it out there. But on the back end, you can either like filter that out or only expose certain functionality, that sort of stuff. So I think that's a good solution. I think that's a good solve is you can only create your turn. Your turn comes with a created at timestamp. We use that to inform the timer. Yeah, I think that's solid. It is also not what I did, but I may adapt it because I think that it's there's a little less overhead for it. And one of the reasons I didn't do it is that I would need to re-architect some things because I'm not treating the turns as objects. So I would have to kind of get that in there to some degree. I think I'd have to re-architect the structure.
I keep interrupting and not letting you tell me the solution you came up with.
The conversation, man.
But one small detail, and I don't know if you did it this way or not. I wouldn't propose using the created at timestamp on the active record object. I would propose having the front end send the start time, and then put that in, just because you don't know what the network latency is going to be.
No, that's a good point too. I also like that quite a bit. I think I always want to do something clever like that. I'm like, oh, you don't even need to send data. You just got to create the object, and then you just have the information you need. But you're right. You don't necessarily have an accurate representation of the moment at which that person's timer should start.
Yeah. Like, from a logical standpoint, that seems like the right thing to do. But from a practical standpoint, I don't know. It might be over-engineering because, like, is the latency ever going to be, like, a full second or 2 seconds? It's probably not going to be. So that might be overkill. I would probably, like, see how it goes and, like, either do that or don't based on what the real latency is.
Yeah, I agree. I think to some degree, and like I said, this doesn't exist yet, or it exists, but it is not available for play at the moment. So I don't know yet what those latency numbers look like. I don't know yet what the real concerns are. And so I think defaulting to maybe the most generic approach is the right way to do it, which I think your timestamp idea is right, because it will be correct in more situations than the created at timestamp might be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if we wanted to change it, I would want to make that change after having real world information to inform my decisions and say, you know, this is or is not a reasonable change based on what I know about an actual production environment.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, maybe, and here's this other thing about the security of it. Now that we're restating the solution, again, my concern comes with like sending that timestamp to the server, because again, feasibly you can go and sort of mess with it. And that's why I like the created at. I defaulted to created at because I wanted to use a value that we have full control of. So we don't necessarily have the full control of what timestamp does the user's browser send to that object.
Well, and here's another thought. You could have something on the back end that says, okay, what was the start time we were told? And what time is now? And if it's more than like 2 seconds different, then it should say, hang on, something is weird here. Because like either it's a like fabricated time, or like something's really going wrong with the network and like it's a problem either way. And so it shouldn't be allowed. I'm not sure if that's a good idea, but that's another idea.
You're getting closer to my solution, and I think I'll come out and say it after I comment on this, which I think that's also a good idea. My concern would be I would have a handful of concerns with this. I think it's good at catching fabrications. You're right. I think that you could compare it and say, hey, is this reasonably... like, this is probably the right timestamp based on what time it is now, right? Again, I think you would want to have real-world information to really understand latency, too, and, like, what that looks like. That's one thing I would be concerned about. I would be concerned about latency. If someone does have a slow connection, I don't want to penalize them and say, hey, your activity is suspicious because your internet isn't so good, right? I think that's not ideal for the user experience. And like you said, I mean, it might also indicate to us that there is a problem with latency, which is good to know. But what I don't want to do is I don't want to conflate potential cheating reports with potential latency spike reports. Right. And it's like, how do I tease those two apart? I feel like at that point, we're almost combining you know, I could conceivably get some error reporting that says, hey, like, we're getting a ton of requests and the turn start timestamp looks fishy. It's 2 seconds later than we expect it to be. And now I have to go dig and say, well, are users cheating, or do we have a latency spike, or do we have both at the same time? I think it's hard to deconstruct. So I'll tell you my solution, because it is really close to this like timestamp comparison on the server. And I wrote it down because it like there's some ins and outs here, like a lot of passing values back and forth and double checking things that fits with kind of what we've been talking about. So like I said, there's, you know, basically like say a dozen different events in the game that basically after that event completes, it becomes a person's turn to take an action. And we have this method when we do that, and it's called broadcast user turn. And that just goes out through the channel, and it actually goes out through the individual player channels. And it says, you know, it finds the player based on the ID of whatever player the turn, like whose turn it is. And it gets that channel and it says, hey, go start your turn. At that moment, right after we send the message, because that message goes out and it triggers stuff on the front end of that user. It also like carries along some information and stuff to send to them about like updated game state, whatever they need to know. So we send that out, that message goes out. And then presumably the animations happen and then we kick off the timer, right? But while the animations are going and while that message is getting sent out over the socket, we can do, we can set up our own timer on the back end. And here's where it takes a little bit of like trust, maybe not necessarily trust. It takes a little bit of like forgiveness on the user side in a worst case scenario. So we set up a backend timer with what I call a very forgiving time. And so we take basically the estimated amount of time that the animations will run. We take, and this is a number that I don't have yet, but hopefully we'll hone in on a good one. But we take some estimate of the latency. So we look at real world data. And I think to begin, we would just choose some reasonable number, you know, look at basically average latency from Heroku data centers across the US and like maybe North America. And we say, okay, that's our estimate. And we can update that as we get real data for our system. So we add latency estimate. We add our animation estimate. And then we add the time limit, but we multiply it by like 50%. So 1.5 times the time limit, just in case. And so that's just like an active job. And so we set that up. I've got Sidekick set up and I say, you know, here's the forgiving time, latency plus animation plus 1.5 times the time limit. Come back after that number of milliseconds and see if anything has happened. And we pass it two arguments. I give it the current player that is like, should be taking the action and the current timestamp from the server. So I trust it completely. I trust it as much as I trust it. Any server, right? Like, but as much as we should, right? Because everything's running on these computers. So I trust it much more than whatever timestamp I might get back from the browser. So then we send that begin user turn out to the front end through the WebSocket. It runs through its sequence of animations. Everyone sees the animations because it'll also send out messages to the whole table. And then for the user whose turn is beginning, at the end of their animations, we send back a message and we say start turn timer. And it does exactly what you had suggested, which is basically it updates. And I've got a column on the player model that says like last turn start, I think is the name of the column, or a turn started at. And it updates it with the timestamp from the browser. Actually, it might be, hold on, let me look at the code. I don't think it's from the browser. I send a message. Here's another divergence here. And it's, again, part of this, like, not trusting the input from the browser. I just send a message. So I have the, like, consumer of the WebSocket send a message back to the channel on the server. And it just says, hey, update the time that my turn started. But like you said, maybe there's some latency issues. So I might dig into this a little better and see what I think is the best solution between send the timestamp from the browser, or do I trust that latency won't be an issue? But again, this is kind of why I added those, like that forgiving timer to the sidekick job. So it says, hey, update this player and tell us when the turn started, right? And then presume that they get, you know, 15 seconds to take their action. If they take their action, we basically flag. Oh, no, we don't do that. I did that for a week and then I took it off because we don't even need to. The timer comes back from sidekick. So if it's 15 seconds, you're talking like 25 to 30 seconds, depending on some of these numbers that we have, right? But, you know, say 30 seconds later, it comes back and it says, hey, like, it looks at the last turn action timestamp on that player. And then it looks at the timestamp of their last action. Whenever players take actions, those actions get timestamps because we kind of record all the game activity, and it compares them. And it says, you know, one, if there is no last action that is after that timestamp, then this person has definitely missed their turn. Right? Like if it's not the range, then the sidekick job can say, and we've got a function that is basically a missed turn function. And we can say, hey, if nothing's happened, just run the missed turn logic. But if something has happened, then we're feeling good that it probably happened within the time frame that we care about. And the reason for this sidekick job that comes up is, one, I think it's an unlikely scenario that people would be our specific audience of like friendly games where you know people. I don't think you've got a lot of people who are going to go to such lengths to cheat. Because you'd have to write a lot of code to do it. But hey, you know, I don't know the people in question, and I think that some people lack the scruples. It would also be a fun technical challenge. Like, I think I would be interested in trying to break it just to see if I could, so I can conceive of why people might try and cheat.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about the like cost-benefit analysis of preventing this type of cheating. And as we talk about all that would be involved to like prevent this type of cheating with a high level of certainty, it seems like maybe the cost is greater than the benefit. And another thing to take into account would be like the stage of the business and the number of users on the system and stuff like that. And so the cost might be too great, but also as you're talking, I had yet another idea, and I'm not saying this is necessarily a good idea because this again might be overly costly against the likelihood of somebody taking advantage of this hole. But the idea is that if presumably all the players are seeing the same thing at the same time, meaning the animation ends at the same time for everybody, then all the users could send a request to the server saying, hey, the next user's turn is supposed to start right now. And then on the back end, you could make sure they reasonably match.
Yeah, that thought also came to mind early on. You are right about one assumption and wrong about another. You are correct that it is too costly and not worth doing. Because all of a sudden, because you can have up to 9 players, and so now you're tracking that information across 9 channels, basically, and you have to write some interesting logic that basically says, like, wait for the number of players to come back and give me this timestamp and then do something with that timestamp, either storing it or comparing it, whatever it is. So there's a lot of overhead here. And you bring up a good question about if this is worth it for the business. And what I will say is the solution that I have so far is maybe 10 lines of code total. So in terms of like developer time, not a lot of cost, maybe more in terms of like me thinking it over and you know, spending the time, you know, kicking it around my head. But it ended up the implementation was not a heavy lift. It is, you know, we already have sidekick. We already need background jobs. So to some degree, this is filling up our, you know, Redis server. It is like going to cost some amount of money. But again, I think it's marginal in terms of like how much these timers are going to take, because many of them, I would say the overwhelming majority of them, you know, they'll be fine. They'll just come back and they'll just not do anything. They'll just say, oh, everything's cool, right? So the overwhelming majority of those won't need to run any like serious actions. Although what we should do is keep an eye on, you know, is this eating up 80% of our Redis capacity? Because every turn is enqueuing a job, right? I think that's something to keep an eye on. So yeah, you are right to wonder about the cost of the cost benefit of figuring out the solution. But, and here is kind of another contributing reason of why it's valuable. You said, assuming the animations end at the same time. They don't, they probably never will, because the animations are kicked off by some message from the server. That message is going to have a variable latency to people's browsers, and then the browsers are going to have some variable time. I mean, we are really talking milliseconds. So in a practical sense, you know, if you and I were playing, it would probably be imperceptible to us. But from like the sense of the server and all these numbers lining up, it does matter at the end of the day. And you've got a lot of data to reconcile. So I think really the fundamental problem here is like, what do we choose as the source of truth for our timer? How much do we trust it implicitly for like cheating sake? And how reliable is it to keep the game moving and to keep people playing? Because there's another kind of ancillary consideration here is that, you know, sure, we're talking about maybe cheating and maybe that's unlikely and we're not too worried about it because it's not like we don't do payouts. There's not actual money on these tables, right? Like you don't stand to win any dollars if the other people you're playing with believe that you have acted like in a bad way, right? Like they're your friends. They'll be like, no, dude, you clearly cheated. Because if you set the game timer to be 15 seconds and someone takes a minute to take their turn, you'll be like, well, the game is broken, right? And that's really the risk. It's like, I don't think you run a risk of like somehow conning your friends at this table out of thousands of dollars and it was worth it to write that script to drop into the browser. But what it does do is it like degrades our customers' trust in our product. And that's what I really care about, is I want our customers to really feel like when they say 15 seconds, our game is going to enforce 15 seconds. And it will do so consistently, but it will also be reasonable about animations and latency changes and a number of other variables. Like that's the real crux of this. And so again, what is the source of truth? How much do we trust it? And how consistent can it be? That is like, those are the challenges. And so, you know, we can't rely on 9 different browsers on 9 different internet connections to give us the same.
I might push back against that.
Oh, yeah?
Because I would offer a proposition that if the humans playing the game perceive it as fair, then it is fair. And it doesn't matter about the fine precision of like, was it really 15 seconds or 15 and a half seconds or 14 seconds or whatever. As long as it looks and feels like 15 seconds to everybody. And even if people like know somehow that like, okay, sometimes it's 14 seconds, sometimes it's 16 seconds, but it's always about 15 seconds, then I think that's probably good enough. I don't know if my proposition is right, but I would offer that proposition to think about.
Yeah, I think that's a good call. And I don't think I don't have a definite response to it. I think that at face value, I agree. I agree that at the end of the day, especially by the nature of what we're building here, the thing that matters is people's perceptions. And so I think you're right. If they perceive it as fair, it is fair. That is the answer. But, and this is just a guess, so I will not like actually say that this is a rebuttal because I don't know for sure. My guess is the kind of people that poker is their favorite game, they do care about precision. I play poker. It's one of the things that I love about this game is like, I've started playing poker since working on this project. I did not play poker until I began working on this project. And I love it a lot. And in reading poker forums, I mean, it's all statistics, right? It's all probability. And I think that the kind of people that set up these kinds of games, I think it would be fair to guess, and I'll just stop, you know, positing after this because I don't have the actual information to say if I'm right or wrong. I think it would be fair to guess that out of any group of people playing this game, three or more together, one of those people is going to care. And enough so that they might convince their friends not to use our platform, because they're like, I don't want to use that platform. I don't think it's consistent. And if one person out of a consistent group of customers has that opinion, it's not just one person we lose, because this is fundamentally a group product. So like, if that group of friends isn't going to play it, like if one of their friends who they want at all of their games refuses to use the product, we've lost more than one customer.
Well, this would be an interesting question to find out the answer to. And obviously this is a non-technical question that informs the technical decisions. As long as we're talking about gambling, I would bet $100 that you're wrong about that.
Okay.
Because like I play poker, or at least I used to, and like none of the times that I ever played poker has like the length of the turn come into the picture, and nobody's ever been like, hey, you're taking too long, hurry up with your turn.
Sure.
So
have you played a lot of online poker though?
Never played online poker at all.
Okay. I think it's a different demographic. And I think with different expectations.
I rescind my offer to bet you $100.
I would put 10 on it. I can, we can do a follow up and I'll see if I can get some user surveys out there once we've got a million people playing our game, you know, every day, which I fully anticipate to happen.
So that would be an interesting question.
How
much do people care about the timing of it, the precision?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're right. I think the principle that you brought up of cost benefit there is a really good question to ask. And I think for this series of, you know, how I would build it, I think it's an important question to ask. It's like, almost like, would I build it? Right. Like,
yeah. Cause it has to be true. It has to be true that people care about the length of the turns. And it also has to be true that there are players who are tech savvy enough and like malicious enough to go under the hood and like change the JavaScript so that they can cheat their way into some extra turns, extra turn length or something like that. And they also, like, that person would have to be smart enough to do that, but also like maybe dumb enough to think that nobody would notice. Because like, if you're going to give yourself a meaningful amount of extra time, like it would have to be like, people are going to notice, unless you're only giving yourself like an extra 2 seconds or something like that. And if you're going to go to that, all that extra effort, what's an extra 2 seconds going to do for you?
Correct. I'm with you there. I think that that is a good analysis. I have one more angle that I want to put out there, because this one I think is more realistic, and it has for me justified the time thinking about and building the solution. If the timer never starts for some reason, because packets got dropped, someone refreshed at the critical moment that their browser was going to execute sending that message, the game ends up in a broken state. Because if there is no timer, and like, and I think what I'm really thinking about is like an internet connection issue, because like, sure, maybe the timer doesn't get sent off, but that person is still in the game and they take an action, it will continue moving forward. The game will not be broken. But if someone's internet cuts out at like the critical moment that that message back to the server saying, hey, my timer has started, got sent out and it missed, I don't want the server to hang. And like, one of the things is, you know, unlike many other kinds of web applications where sometimes refreshing is all you need to do, it is the case that if you refresh this poker application, it actually like, it can fix like visual bugs and like animation things. Like, it will always, on a fresh reload, you will get correct game state information. So that's like is a feature of this, is that like, we always want to make sure that if you drop in at any time, you will get the accurate information about the state of the game. So that's good. But if you were to not come back, there is no, the other people playing, like if they refresh their browser, it doesn't start your timer, right? Because you do have the separation where, you know, in a lot of web applications, you are the only person in the current execution of the code. But in this case, you have many people sharing it, and you have some private channels of code that only one person out of the group at a time has any influence on. And so the server can kind of be like an arbiter of making sure the game never finds itself irreparably broken. So that's why the sidekick job, and that's again why, like I said, you know, if you've got a 15-second timer, the sidekick job, as of right now, it'll come back in 30 seconds.
And wait, that's what's not the purpose of the sidekick job again?
So before we send the message to the game client saying start this person's turn, we enqueue a sidekick job, and we say come back in some amount of time, and we say it's 1.5 times the turn length plus like how long we think the animation will run plus some estimate of latency. And so that, you know, adds up right now to like 30 seconds if you got a 15-second time limit. And that comes back. And this is like the sidekick job is, in my mind, like what we're really discussing about if it's worth it or not, because that was the only thing that I really, that took like any thought at all. The rest of it, you know, setting up a timer, getting the timer to run after the animation, that first part, that was, if anything, it was very natural to add it. It felt like it was part of a sequence of events. And I was like, right, we can drop that there and we can send this information there. But the real question was, what do we do if we're just not getting the right information? And like, if the first thoughts for me are like people acting in bad faith, but like also there are technical challenges of like internet connections dropping out. And that's what
what's the job doing at the end? Like if it runs for 50 seconds and it checks, mm-hmm. like if it doesn't see what it expects to see, like what is it checking for and what happens?
It checks. So when we enqueue the job, we give it a timestamp and we say, this is the beginning of the turn. And then we also give it a reference to the player whose turn it is. When the job comes back, it looks at the player and it looks for the timestamp of their last action. And so it compares that against what it knows the start time for the turn to be. And it has some logic and it basically says, if their last action wasn't after the turn started, because presumably they could have taken an action two turns ago or one turn ago, basically we say, did this person take an action after their turn started? If they have not yet taken an action, and so again, for specifics, you've got a 15-second time limit. You start your turn. The job comes back in 30 seconds. If you have not registered an action in 30 seconds, at this point, the job runs, there's another method that is basically, there's a miss turn function, because when you miss a turn, there's some logic about what action do you take? Do you check? Do you fold? Do you get sat out? All that sort of stuff. And so we just run the miss action turn. It's actually the same logic as in the front end, when your timer, if you're playing and it's your turn, your browser has a little timeout function. And that timeout function is set to be precisely 15 seconds, right? So you have a lot less room there. And then if that runs out, we send out a missed turn message to the server. And that basically says like, hey, the browser just told me that you missed your turn, right? That's like the typical, that's what will usually happen. And then it'll run the missed turn logic.
Why have the sidekick job instead of at the end of that timer ending the turn at that point and saying if there was no action during the turn, then you missed your turn?
And this is exactly the thing. If someone lost their internet, their browser is not going to send the timeout.
Okay. And I'm trying to think of like, okay, if there's no sidekick job, and mm-hmm. the normal thing that's supposed to happen is a request is sent 15 seconds after the start of the turn. Their internet goes out. Then it seems like what I would want to happen is that the front end says, wait a second, I sent the end of turn request, but I didn't get a response from the server. So we need to like go into a different state of the game that says like, hey, things are not okay. Everything like freezes or whatever happens when things go wrong. and it says like your internet's bad, blah blah blah.
What happens to the other players?
What happens to the other players? Okay, so it seems like the same thing would need to happen to the other players. Like the whole game would need to go into that state for everybody, because if it's broken for anybody, then it's broken for everybody. And so the server would know that it didn't get that end of turn signal. Oh, hang on a second. How would it know that it didn't get that end of turn signal?
It would need to come back and check.
Yeah.
So you've got another assumption off from what the reality is on the ground. And this is just a requirements thing. It is not the case that if a game breaks for one person, it should break for everyone else or end or pause. If someone's internet goes out, and this is actually a specific requirement of our game, if your internet goes out and you're playing, the rest of your table should basically be able to play through your internet troubles.
Got it. Okay.
And we handle it basically like the way we handle it is, so we actually have a catch for, so someone disconnects. So if their internet goes out, you are right to think about like what happens when that disconnect happens, because Action Cable has like a disconnect function, and it can detect when channels are disconnected. So we actually run, we basically say like, you know, we do some series of cleanup, and we say, hey, like sit this person out, or like, you know, whatever it is, we run the checks we need to run when a person disconnects to make sure the game can keep going. But there is like, there are some holes to that. We don't always know precisely the nature of the disconnection. We just know that the channel has been disconnected, and we want to handle that separately from that logic of what happens when a channel is broken versus what happens when a timer response or a turn response has not come back in an adequate amount of time. And that's why we have the sidekick job. But it answers that question of how does the server know is something wrong?
Got it. So I concede that the sidekick job is necessary. Let me scrutinize a detail of the sidekick job. Does the length of the sidekick job really need to be so precise, like 1.5 times the turn length plus some estimated latency and stuff like that? Could it not just be like a hard-coded 1 minute or 45 seconds or something?
It could not be hard-coded because we allow people to customize the timer length. So like we always need to like check the game settings, because feasibly like a person setting up a game could give their friends 15 minutes to take their turns. So you don't want to set that check to come back in a minute on a game that has 15 minute timers.
Got it.
But you are right. Like, I think you've got a good question about, does it need to be so close to the time limit? My thoughts on this were a quality of life improvement, or maybe it was just my own sensibilities of, you know, what I wanted it to be. Because I guess the way that I started, my position was, I basically want it to be exact. Like in an ideal scenario, I would actually only have one timer, right? I would really just have one timer that was 15 seconds long. I don't think that's possible to meet all the requirements of this problem. And the compromise that I made was having basically a secondary timer. So the primary timer happens on the front end. And I would say 99% of the time, that's what's going to trigger and fire and do all of its stuff, is like really those user timers are going to be the primary actor in this scenario. But for that 1% of time where connections get dropped, wires get crossed, whatever happens, the sort of stuff that, like, you know, the unknown unknowns of what breaks a timeout message, this is my safeguard. And again, the position I had when I started was, an ideal situation is that the safeguard timer is 100% in sync with the primary timer. But like, again, I think the practicalities of that are impossible or not worth the time investment to sync it up 100%. So giving myself a little bit of flexibility and saying that it is the configurable by the person who starts the game, it is the time limit that they specified plus some forgiving number of milliseconds or seconds. And that includes latency estimates, it includes animation time, and then it just includes a buffer, because I don't know what might go wrong. So I want to keep it close to, my initial thought was keep it close to the actual timing of the timer. But I think you've got a good point that maybe it doesn't need to be that precise. Maybe it could just be some more fixed number of milliseconds, and like it just comes back and periodically checks. Because then your worst case scenario is if you end up in this broken state, you will fix your broken state at a predictable time. And it might not be 30 seconds, it might be 60. But again, like you said, you've got a broken game. So probably if you're on a Skype call or chatting with your friends, someone's like, hey, I disconnected, and people have a sense that like it's going to take a minute to resolve. One way or another, we do need to resolve it. We need to give people, and it needs to be automatic, because we don't want players troubleshooting these connection issues themselves. We want the game to operate smoothly, even if some percentage of your players are having some connection issues.
Yeah, I have a similar feature that I've been working on, or at least it's similar in some ways. There's this, so I work for a medical clinic and I work on their EMR. And each time a patient has an appointment, we save data for one of any number of modules, one or more of any number of modules. And so there might be two people who want to look at the same module at the same time, and maybe even edit the same module at the same time. But that's not okay, because they can conflict with each other. Because like if one person saves what they put and the other person saves what they put, whoever did it last will overwrite whatever the other person did. And to make that problem even worse, we have this autosave feature that we recently added, where it autosaves whatever's in the form every 5 seconds.
Sure.
And so I wasn't thinking about the conflict problem when I first coded this. And so like person A and person B could be on, they could be on different computers with the same module open at the same time. And they would just override each other every 5 seconds. And so that was bad and could lead to very confusing behavior. And even the same person might be logged in on two different computers. That's not an uncommon scenario. Anyway, we introduced the idea of a lock, so that if you get to that module first, you have the lock on it. And if anybody else visits that same module, they see that it's locked and the form is disabled.
Sure. It's kind of like the classic, that's any number of editing software, right? I mean, other than these great like real-time Google Docs, etc.
Yeah,
but like it's like WordPress editing. It's been a while since I've been working at a place where multiple people were accessing a WordPress site, but I did work at a place where that was our primary website, and so you would get those notifications. You can't edit this. Someone else is, or you could try and kick them out to any number of those things. It sounds like you've got that kind of situation.
Yeah. So the part that's relevant to this is the release of the lock.
Okay.
So when should the lock get released? The lock should get released whenever you're done editing the module, so that somebody else can edit it if they need to. But how do we know when you're done? Because if you just navigate away to a different page, that's one way. There's a close button that you can click. That's another way. And if you click the close button, then that's very clear. The lock should be freed up at the time you click the close button. But if you just navigate away, it's not clear. Or like, what if you just get up from your computer and walk away? So there is a cron job that runs every 15 seconds that checks. I forget exactly how it checks, but it checks every 15 seconds and says like, I want to look at it now. But basically it frees up the lock if you've been inactive. And my point with all that is that this cron job doesn't need to be that precise. It just needs to be, it just needs to be longer enough than 5 seconds that it won't be a problem. I'm going to look at that now, because like I'm bothered by not remembering what that is.
Yeah. And I would also ask, I think the same question you asked me about my sidekick job is the one that I have for you about this cron job, is the cost benefit analysis of maintaining it, having it running on the server. I've been listening to your show for maybe well over a year now. So I know the evolution of this system. So you've got your EC2 instances, how much memory is that eating up for you running every so often? And is there, you know, because what I thought would be instead of the on job is to do my solution, which is to kick off a sidekick task when people begin the editing workflow. Right, because if your cron job is running every X number of minutes, is it always running even if no one has begun editing?
Mm-hmm.
I would say, why have that constantly running, even like through the night or at times when people don't need it? I would start a side if you've got a sidekick or whatever you're using for background jobs. I would set it off then, have that come back and check at some appropriate timing, and if it's still being edited, take whatever action it needs to. Either release the lock one or reset or like enqueue itself again to come back and check later. And then I think you could save yourself some cron time, one. I personally don't like maintaining cron jobs. I think that's, I have a distaste for it because it's hard to version control it. I like all my stuff to be in my Git repository. I know there's Whenever-ize, which I imagine you can use on EC2. I'm on Heroku, so I don't have the option to sort of like version control my cron configuration. I have to use the Heroku scheduler. And so that's all like external config. Perhaps there's a YAML file I can add somewhere. Anyways, I would kind of adapt my approach and do something that I could do in code that says, if you've opened up this form, let's kick off a task to come back at some amount of time and keep checking to see if we need to release the lock. And then once you release the lock, you stop running your task entirely. And then you only re-enqueue that the next time someone opens up the form.
So you're wrong. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
First, let me explain how this cron job works, because I didn't remember, but I'm looking at it now. So the logic that I used was that if the autosave process is happening and there's a request coming across every 5 seconds that saves the form, if that's still happening, then you must still be on the page. And if it's not still happening, then you must not be on that page anymore.
Sure.
So I did a check that said, has it been long enough since the most recent autosave request that we can know that that person's not on the page anymore?
Sure.
And that's the reason for like the 15 seconds, because if it's been 10 seconds, then, well, okay.
You're within the autosave time frame, right?
Yeah. I can't do the math. Logic right on the fly.
When I was describing mine as well, the time at which this number of seconds is challenging to say out loud, but it is, yeah. So your cron job basically is saying, let's make sure it's appropriate that it could even possibly know whether or not someone is still editing, and you set that to the interval that represents the autosave.
Yeah, and I remember I had a whole relatively long stretch of a conversation with my boss about why it needed to be 15 seconds and not 10 seconds. I don't even know if we came to the right conclusion about that. Anyway, 15 seconds is enough to know. To respond to what you said regarding the cost thing, the only kind of cost I care about at our scale is developer time cost.
Sure.
Like server cost is not very relevant for us because the whole thing runs on two servers. And the only reason there's two servers instead of one is for redundancy in case something bad happens to one. And then we have a third server for, background job. It's a worker instance.
Yeah.
So that part is fine. I forget the other. Oh yeah. Why not have like a sidekick job? My question for that would be, how long should that sidekick job run for?
You would get the same amount of time that you set your cron jobs to come back.
Oh, so would you enqueue a new one every time the autosave did a save?
Yeah. Or whenever it came back and found that the person was still editing. But I would re-enqueue it, right? I would basically what I'm suggesting is, and I think you're right, because I know, like you said, this is kind of internal office use. It's not like, I bet you could fill up your cron tab with 1,000 jobs and no one would know or care. And if you needed to like bump up your RAM on your EC2 instance, it would cost you like $2 more a month, right? So like, again, you're not thinking about scaling out to thousands and hundreds of thousands, millions of people and what that cost looks like, right? But just thinking about like how I would approach it, and again, from a different angle of, I don't know, maybe we would need to scale out and why maintain all of those cron jobs? And again, I also just don't like cron jobs. That's just me. I would say instead of having this regular repeating cron job that's running every 15 seconds, and it sounds like regardless of the state of the system, you have that cron job running. I think that to me, I only want this repeating task to be executing when it needs to be, which would be to me, if you open the form to start editing, you enqueue a job. The job comes back in 15 seconds, same time interval you've got your cron job running at. I also like it because it is, and maybe this is why you had to do 15 instead of 10, because it's tied to the moment that your autosave started firing, right? Because like otherwise, because you could conceivably, if your 15 seconds was the wrong number of time, you could conceivably come back at the wrong time. If someone opened and started autosaving in the middle of your interval, right? And then you're getting incorrect data there. So I wonder if that's how you arrived at 15 seconds. But again, I would enqueue a job that is tied not to a fixed interval in time, but rather is tied to the moment at which we want to begin checking. And this goes back to my poker timer. What is the moment that we want to start checking this timer? Kick it off to sidekick, come back, see what needs to happen, enqueue itself again if you're still going, or take any action that needs to happen for cleanup.
Yeah, I can't think of any reason why that wouldn't work. Because again, you're doing...
when it comes to cron jobs versus sidekick, and this is just another personal preference thing, it's easier for me personally to version control my sidekick jobs than my cron tasks. And I know that you've got Ansible, you've probably got some infrastructure stuff that helps with that. And there's the Whenever-ize gem, which turns your cron configuration into code. So that's useful. Again, I can't use it because it doesn't work on Heroku.
I tried to use Whenever-ize recently and it just like, it either didn't work or like I went down that path and I realized it didn't make sense or something.
Sure.
So I'm not a fan of that gem either.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, so I think, you know, writing jobs that get enqueued, I mean, that's all in code versus the cron job, which is some external system. Again, if you got Ansible and stuff and you can, you know, put that in a playbook and that gets set up, I think that's plenty fine as well. But
let me share real quick how I'm doing that.
Yeah, show me.
So the mechanism that does the check every 15 seconds that asks the question, has an autosave happened recently? Mm-hmm. That's in a rake task. So that's still like inside the application. And then for the cron job, I do have an Ansible playbook where it specifies all my cron jobs.
Sure.
And so that's just like...
Is that in... I never use Ansible. Do your playbooks live in your repository or do they live elsewhere?
For me, it lives in the repository. I don't know what other people typically do, but awesome. I can't think of how it would make a lot of sense to have it outside.
Okay. So you've solved my personal preference problem, right? If I was working on this code base, I'd be like, great, it's in the Git repo.
And here's the other difference. I don't know if this would, I don't know if this makes it better or worse, or if it's even a big enough difference to be a meaningful difference. But if you were to go to the sidekick route, okay, there's people using this application all day, every day. It's right now there's like 30 or 35 people who work there. So if we have like at the same time, we have 30 people looking at these modules, then we would have 30 times the number of autosaves that happen or whatever, that many sidekick jobs. Sure. Whereas with the cron approach, there's just one single cron job that checks globally for everybody.
Yeah.
That's probably not a big enough difference to make a real difference.
No, you've got a good point. And it's funny, after saying all this, I have actually done, the reason that I know so much about this, or that this cron stuff is top of mind for me, I have a similar task. We close out games after 24 hours of inactivity, because the end of a poker game is kind of hard to say. Sometimes you take a break for an hour. So I had the same conversation with the company, and we were talking about basically when should we check on that 24 hours? And they wanted to basically enqueue a job for every game. And I said, no, let's just do it in one job. And so I also have a cron job that runs at 4 a.m. every day. And it just runs once, and it checks all the games. And it says basically, when was your last action? And it closes it out if it's longer than 24 hours. So I'm actually right there with you on this specific thing. I was kind of locked into this other, you know, sidekick background job thing. But you make a really good point about how many jobs would you end up enqueuing if many people were opening these forms.
Yeah, and I want to really emphasize that, like, I don't view that as a significant point necessarily, because sure. Again, the thing that matters most to me is the cost, the developer cost of maintaining, and like the cost, like the mental burden cost of the whole thing. Like, how easy is, if a sidekick job is more expensive in terms of infrastructure, but it's easier to understand, then like I would absolutely go for that approach.
Yeah, and I think that's the fundamental thing here, is we're really just talking about preferences, because I think for both of us, you know, I have a product that is not yet launched. You've got a small office software. I think you're right. It's the developer time is like the most expensive piece of our products. And that's where we got to really optimize for like what makes sense to the people who are working on it. In your case, it's you. In my case, it's me. And I think that's just the fundamentals of it.
Yeah. I don't think I agree that it's like a preference thing and like each way is equally good and it's just like whatever you prefer. I think the significant thing is exactly what you said, which is like, how easy does it make it to maintain the application for the developers? Because like infrastructure is relatively cheap. Developers are relatively expensive.
Yeah. And that's why I think it is a preference thing. Because I think you got different developers here, which we are certainly highlighting in this episode, which I think is interesting. But yeah, I'm with you about your approach there. I think that, you know, and I think we're splitting hairs, which is fun and interesting to do in this medium, because it's a podcast about development. I don't think I would ever, we've now been talking for a little over an hour, I would never go to my boss about this. I would never spend an hour of my boss's time, like really getting in these details. I would ask for their priorities, what they need to make the business work, and then I would figure it out. And if I had other developers, maybe it warrants a 20, 30 minute conversation, you know, but this podcast is fun. It's educational. It's interesting. I think that's why it's worthwhile to like really break it down and hyper-analyze these things. But yeah, you know, if I make all these choices, we're talking about the, how would I build it? You know, I made them while I was working. Like I was working for an hour or two and I was like, yep, this is what I'm going to do. And then I did it. And now that's what it is. And like, that was the right call because I didn't agonize over it for 8 hours without, you know, moving forward on the problem.
Yeah. And the wisdom there is like, no matter how much time you spend on it upfront, you're unlikely to get the right answer the first time anyway. So most of the time it's better just to do something and then see how you like it after the fact, see what problems and weaknesses it has and stuff like that. And then if there's a problem, you can always go back and fix it. That seems like a good place to end it. Tyler, thanks for coming on the show and doing this. Where can people go to learn more about you and about Home Game Poker?
Yeah, we are, again, not live yet. I don't know when you'll be publishing the episode. Mid-October, we'll have some landing pages up. Start Googling around for Home Game Poker. If you're a poker player and you want to play with your friends and keep a respectful distance during the global pandemic, I think we will have a product that really meets your needs. I'm excited to put it out there in the world. For me, myself, you can find me on Twitter. I'm there all the time. Jason and I go back and forth every so often. It's just Tyler Williams, C as in Connecticut, T as in Tyler. Tyler Williams CT, that's where I'm from. That's my Twitter handle. And then I do freelance work as Ogden Studios, and that's .xyz. So Jason, thanks for having me. This has been great.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on the show.